Hi, I'm Mike.
And I'm...
Hi, this is Audie Martello, host of the Catskills Cafe on WIOX and Secretary of the Board of Margaretville Hospital, celebrating its 50th year of local health care in the Catskills at the All That Glitters Harvest Moon Ball, coming up on Saturday, September 7th at Shepherd Hills Golf Course in Roxbury. Dinner, dancing, and fireworks. For reservations, harvestmoonreservations@gmail.com. Hey, I hope to see you there. I also want to let you know that the Auxiliary Summer Flea Market will return next summer.
WIOX is supported by the Slighter Agency on Main Street in Margaretville, a neighborhood independent insurance agency educating consumers about the joys and challenges of owning a second home. And about coverage options. Open Monday through Friday, 8:30 till 5. More information at 845-586-2641 or slideragency.com.
You're listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, and everywhere at WIOXradio.org, where it's easy to donate if you like what you hear. You can also get WIOX on any smart device through the TuneIn or FM radio apps. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic. Every third Wednesday, we talk to Mr. Gary Mead from Fruitful Furnishings Sawmill and Gary Mead Gallery in Margaretville. But before we get into tonight's topic, which is going to be on bark peeling and tanning in the Catskills, past and present, Gary, what have you been up to?
Oh, we've just been running the mill and making art. Making art, yeah.
What kind of art are you making?
Well, I'm designing a new line called Affordable Art, which are dining room tables. And I'm working on finishing up the From the Forest piece. I have another animal character that's going to be... It's in the kiln now being dried, and it's a beaver. And I'm very excited. So I have one more character after this, a skunk. And then that will be finished. But I started this in 2012, and, you know, it just takes, some of these things take time. You know, I do it in my spare time when I'm, you know, between running the mill and all that. So, you know, it actually, but these affordable art tables are coming out really nice. They're the first two I made. I have the pieces cut for the third one. I haven't assembled it yet, but the first two I made are... all out of spalted hard maple, and they're really beautiful. And there's some redneck engineering involved in these tables, And if you're interested in what I'm talking about, come to the gallery and I'll show you. These are very simple to put together and take apart and extremely sturdy. And they're kind of, I label them a country, contemporary country. They're a country-looking table, but they're very contemporary-looking. They're straight-lined, and they're simple. There's, you know, no curves and waves like a lot of other stuff I make. But, you know, they're affordable dining room tables that don't take hundreds of hours to make.
And well, Gary, I like your table there. Might have to bring you up on that.
Yeah, I'll bring you down, and we'll negotiate something. Might have to send one of your kids over, but...
No, I'll pay cash, Gary. Cash.
All right.
Cash is fine.
Yeah, we'll work something out.
You know, but the kids you get a lot for, Gary. Yeah. Come on. You have to make a lot of tables for a kid.
Oh, yeah, yeah. My, actually, I made my two sons' dining room tables, and Max and Lindsay, their kids beat the crap out of their table. It's wormy maple, but, you know, we have to actually put a finish, but... Aaron and Matt, their dining room table's hickory, and they don't let their kids draw on it. But, you know, I'm the guy that let them use it. I mean,
it's
that's
character.
What it's for. It adds character, yeah.
And Gary, what wood do you recommend for someone who has kids that beat the crap out of things?
Oh, anything.
Anything.
I mean, no matter what, wood dents, metal dents. I mean, there's... And people ask me that all the time, what kind of wood doesn't dent? I said, there isn't a wood that you can't, it won't, everything's going to scratch and dent.
Well, is there one that might hold up a little more?
Well, the hickory and the white oak and the black walnut are the harder of the...
White oak's pretty good to water, too, right?
Yeah, white oak's pretty good.
Spilling milk, yeah. Juice.
Well, a good finish will keep any table, a good finish will, it's like a foundation to your table. That if you don't put a finish on any wood, it will just get destroyed in no time. But
yeah, but then the kid takes an instrument and just carves into the finish, past into the wood.
Well, that's kind of, well.
These kids are crazy.
I know. Well, Max's kids took forks and
yeah, exactly.
Put them slamming down on the table.
The other day I came
both
in
ends of the fork,
yeah.
Not only the sharp end, but the butt end, boom, boom, boom. There's all kinds of dents and stuff, but it's wormy, soft maple.
Yeah.
And it just, actually, Lindsay, they spilled stuff on it. The finish is kind of worn off. And this summer we're taking it, I mean, before winter, we're going to take it out on the porch, and I'm going to put another coat of finish on it. But like I say, Matt and Aaron's hickory table, they don't let their kids play at the table and do our pictures and do that. But, you know, like I say, they're meant to use and abuse, and it adds character.
Yeah.
And but you never wear them out. They don't wear out.
Oh, well, you can see where, you know, some of these old tables where the guy is putting his cigarette out on. I like that, you know?
Yeah.
It's character.
But... That's kind of far-fetched for a character, but...
Ah, come on.
I mean, that in bars, I could see a bar top or something, but, you know, nobody smokes anymore. It shouldn't be smoking, so, you know, we won't be putting our cigarettes out on the table.
All right.
But all that stuff does add character. But we'll get into talking a little about... I wanted to touch a little bit on many things. This hour is going to go fast as heck, but anyway... there's a lot to talk about with tanning, but the first few things I want to talk about, the months of peeling bark we're coming to the end of it now. In my world, it's the full moon in June to the full moon in August. In Ryan's world, it's May.
Memorial Day.
Yeah. So, you know, but I don't peel bark Memorial Day. It's hard. It don't come off good. But anyway, there are certain times of the year when you peel bark, which is, like I said, from, you know, May until August. And then there's one month of the year when if you want the bark to stay on your log or you're making bark siding or whatever, you have to cut it in February. And that's the dead of winter, and the cambrium layer is actually not saturated at that point. It's shrunk right up, and the bark sticks to the cambium. And that is when, you know, any other time of year, you're going to cut a tree down, and the bark will fall off. So you have that one-month window for the bark to stay on, but you have a four-month window for peeling it. And I'm building a house, and I peeled tulip poplar bark from some tulip poplar logs, and I dried them in the kiln, and I have a sample of them in my gallery. I'm siding my house with bark from a tree, and it's beautiful. And it's so amazing that once it's dry, because when you peel it from the log, it's slippery, and all I want to do is curl up, and I put it on a pallet and sticker it, and when I put it in a kiln, I literally put 2,000 pounds of weight on the top of the pallet to hold it flat. When it comes out of the kiln, it saws. You can cross-cut it with your cross-cut saw. You put it through the rip saw. It's like a board, stiff like a board. And you machine it and make it into, they're kind of like shake-style shingles. But, and, you know, this is what I'm siding my house with. And then I have a table in the gallery called Hickory in a Higher Power. Well, I harvested some hickory bark a couple of springs ago, and I kiln-dried them, but I left them in the round. I didn't, and what they did is they rolled inside of itself. They kind of, if you looked at the top view of these pieces, I cut them about 3.5-4 feet, and if you look from the top down, they rolled up like a rolled gold pretzel. If you looked at, that's kind of what they rolled up like. So I used it for this one table. At the top is ingrown bark and bird's eye hickory, and the pedestals for the supporting the base are hickory bark. There's no wood inside it. And they're so strong, and it's amazing. Bark is very mysterious. People never studied it, but I study. I love trees. I love every part of a tree, and they're all useful in some way. And you know, 20 years ago, I what would you do with bark? But you know, throw it over the bank. But now I'm siding my house with it. I'm building furniture from it, and it's very beautiful. And it comes off the trees this time of the year. It's just amazing how nice it peels off and falls off. And you know, the birches are another. This is the time of year if you want to. I know people they take like plywood or boards that are planed, and they'll cut down some, you know, yellow birch or black birch or white birch, peel the bark, and, you know, flatten it out. You know, they just put it out in the sun and put weight on it on a flat surface. When it dries, it's flat. Then they take contact cement or some kind of glue, and they glue it to the wall in their house. And, you know, it is really very beautiful. I've seen people do it on doors. You know, they take a door, it's just a flat panel door, and they'll glue this bark on it, and it lasts. It doesn't shrink, it doesn't move around a lot, and there's a lot to be said about bark. I'm just scratching the surface on it. I have no idea about too much of it, but I do know hickory, tulip poplar, and the birches, and hemlock. Hemlock is another one. The Indians used hemlock on this side of the hill on their longhouses, and hemlock will last 40 to 60 years outdoors untreated. On the other side of the hill where the tulip poplars grew, basically from Kingston all the way down through New Jersey and out through there, they grow huge.
Yeah.
And
big ones, straight, too.
They last 60 to 80 years outdoors untreated. But if you put a preservative on them, they'll, you know, what I'm thinking is I'll have a natural wood product that will outlast vinyl siding, and it's bark of a tree.
Is that like linseed oil or something? Or?
Well, there's so many different... The finishing world is changing so rapidly that I have no handle on it at this point. It, you know, what I was doing 20 years ago, you can't even get that stuff anymore.
What were you doing 20 years ago?
And it's all, everything's turned into a water base and a natural kind of a, which is very cool, but it's a lot more, takes a lot more time to build it up to do the same. You know, you might put 3 or 4 coats of something else on this, you got to put 20 coats on to do this, make the same kind of a protective effect. But you don't have to do the 20 coats all at once. You do maybe 5 or 6, and then a year later you do some more. And, you know, it's a constant. You have to keep applying it. Whereas some of them, you know, spar urethanes and like that, I mean, once every 5 or 10 years, you put another coat on. It's not a yearly process. So, you know, I'm doing, you know, outdoor furniture, and I'm investigating these other type of, you know, generic finishes, water base, that are actually pretty, they're pretty outstanding from what I've seen so far. But, you know, in the past, I've never seen a waterborne finish that was worth a darn. So, because I keep experimenting about every 10 years, but they're better now than they've ever been. And like I say, they're just a lot more work. I mean, you have to put many, many layers on in order to build up the same type of a protective finish. But we should talk a little about tanning before we talk about too much. But, you know, I'm at 1289 Southside Road in Margaretville. If anyone who wants to just learn about anything about wood, and just come to the gallery and walk through. I'm not there, you know, I like to sell stuff, but my whole goal is, I've learned so much about wood in my life that my goal, and I write children's books for this reason, to teach adults and children at the same time, is to educate people on the wealth of our environment here. It's unrealized by, I found, you know, 85 to 90% of the people that live here and come here have no clue of the wealth of where we are. We have the best water in the world. We have the best air in the world. We have the best wood in the world. And we have the best of everything right here. And if you're waking up depressed, there's no reason. You got to be looking at the stuff that we have. We live in a this is heaven on earth where we are.
I got in a conversation with, while I was working for the Catskill Forest Association, with a member in Sullivan County. And, you know, oftentimes, I understand, people get pessimistic about the environment and everything. But I said, you know, there's some bad things going on, sure. But think about all, like no one ever thought our forest would come back, if you probably talked to someone 80, 100 years ago.
Yeah.
People like John Burroughs, famous naturalist of the Catskill Mountains, said we would never have, you know, mink come back and fisher and turkey and deer. Even deer were a novel thing.
Right, yeah.
I mean, and Henry David Thoreau said the same thing. Now, they've all come back. Our forests are back. And in the Catskills, compared to other areas, we have more diversity. I mean, where I live in Olive, you have both the northern and central hardwoods. You have oak, hickory, forest bumping up against maple, beech, and birch. It's great.
That's,
you know,
awesome.
That's a cool thing.
And
pitch,
you know,
pine in between, and black gum and yellow poplar. It's pretty neat.
Oh, my gosh. You know, I get goosebumps just thinking about it. And it's so beautiful, and there's so much out there that, you know, once you learn about it, it makes you excited. And, you know, that's another thing, too, is back in the 1800s, this was 100% hemlock. And, well 90.
Dr. Mike Kudish would dispute it. It doesn't grow above about 2,500 feet,
right.
2,300 feet.
Yeah.
Hemlock starts to drop out into northern hardwoods, and then it goes to boreal if you get high enough, you know, the fir and spruce. But from 2,300 to 30, you know, to 4,000 feet, you're getting northern hardwoods and the spruce fir. But the valleys below that, where most people lived,
just were hemlock.
We're probably a more hemlock.
Yeah.
You know, there's probably some oak, hickory, and chestnut too.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah.
Yeah, well, the Indians started planting those in the valleys along the streams, and, you know.
Perhaps burning too, right? Blueberries.
And the burning as well, yeah. But, you know, there were a lot of hemlocks that the tanning industry basically took down, and that's when our hardwood forest took over.
Absolutely.
They did cut a lot of hemlocks down, to tan hides. And Zodak Pratt, who actually was very well liked in Prattsville, that's why they named Prattsville. There's a museum in Prattsville that I haven't been to yet that I'm going. Excuse me, in the near future. And I was reading a book on him that Mitch gave me, my son, and he was all excited, and we're going to make a date and take a trip over and see. But where the museum is a house that he used to live in. And then there's Pratt Rock over there, and that's where, you know, he had that, that was a monument for where he was wanted to be buried. But he isn't buried there. He's buried in a cemetery somewhere else. But, you know, the stone carver that hollowed out his tomb, that stone for him to be laid in, was actually, it was very painful for him to cut that out enough. And I don't think he had it finished by the time, the you know, Zodak passed away. So they put him in the cemetery, and then the guy finished the tomb, and now it's just a Pratt Rock, I guess they call it. But I want to go over there,
that's
too.
That's the story behind it, huh? Is that, that's how it happened?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I didn't know that.
But he was a... There's a book that I read. It's called Bear Trees, Zodak Pratt, Master Tanner, and the story of what happened to the Catskill Mountain Forest. And I just want to read one caption in here. This is the beginning of the book. Until the advent of the tanning industry, these mountains were a solid mass of hemlock forest. Millions upon millions of cubic feet of giant hemlock were laid to axe, peeled, and in most instances left to rot. By 1890, this unbridled exploitation had destroyed the virgin forest, the tanning industry collapsed, and the mountains grew up again to the hardwoods of today. And that's from the Catskill Mountain House. Roland Van Zandt, 1991 or 1891.
Yeah, one thing I will I'll say is there's probably a lot of beach too. I mean, beach they think was probably over 45% even back then, which makes sense because both beech and hemlock are shade tolerant trees, and in the absence of disturbance will thrive. But for some reason, I find this when we talk about the history of the tanning industry. It's like we jump past agriculture.
Yeah.
What really cleared the land was agriculture. Because really, tanning industry went through and cut it, and then it grew back to blackberries. Well, and, you know, but it grew back instantly. It was the land clearing of farming that really removed the forest.
Right.
Because you put animals on it, and the animals do what? Well, they're a permanent hedge trimmer.
Right.
Or hedge trimmer, they're a permanent vegetation removal source.
Well, first they cut down and took the stumps out, and then until they could grow their crops. And that was a land clearing. But now, Zodak Pratt, when the tanning industry kind of collapsed, that's what he did. He had a farm.
Yeah.
And so the land that he had cleared, he started farming on.
Yeah.
And so it made good sense. But, you know, there's actually nothing wrong with it, but there was a lot of hemlocks that were kind of, you know, peeled the bark, and the wood never got used. But because of that, I have a piece in the gallery called Mother and Child that is my testament to hemlock, because my whole career with working with wood, most loggers or people's attitude is, it's, I heard this over and over, and it just gets in my craw. It's only hemlock. Hemlock was monumental. It was one of the most inspirational woods of our time, of our ancestors' time, of time just in itself. It was one of the most monumental, well, most useful trees that we've ever had to date. And it's only hemlock. And the only reason, you know, loggers say that, because the price never really went up drastically with hemlock. It always stayed at a very kind of a even keel. And, it, you know, the cherries, you know, that go, you know, out of sight, and the red oak and the white oak, and, you know, it brings a very high price. The hemlock, it's kind of stays, but before 1960, all our homes and barns and buildings and were made out. The tanning industry, I mean, Zodak Pratt was world-renowned for his tanning because the hemlock bark, you know, it has that purple tinge to it, and his hides were orange in a color. And they were, you know, around the world he was known for, I mean, this guy in Prattsville was known around the world for his hides, and they, you know, they were, well, he got, you know, back in that, during that period, he got paid a lot of money for his hides because they wanted them, and he come up with different steaming and ways that, to get the hair off without taking the hide, because the scraping, you end up, you know, peeling some of the hide. Well, he'd come up with this way to steam it, and the hair would fall out, and it would, the hide would be, well, in the book it says 80% heavier in weight, so they could use it more for shoes rather than, you know, coats and gloves and stuff, because the heavier stuff was made, leather was made for shoes, and they're called sides and skins. And, you know, I'm not an expert on it by any means, but, you know, I only read the book twice, but I need to keep, when I read a book like this, I have to read it like at least 10 times before I figure out what really is going on. Because the more you do something, the better you get at it. So you just keep practicing. And, you know, when I find something I like, I just keep studying it until I at least scratch the surface of it. And there's no way we're going to know everything about too much. And, you know, it's really, I'm humbled by all the information and all the knowledge there is out there to know. And, you know, once you think you know everything, you're pretty much done, because if you think you know everything, there's no room for growth. And and that's just a phrase that don't even make any sense. You know, I learn new stuff every day, and it's just amazing what's out there. And
well, that's why I hate the term expert. But if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Every third Wednesday, we talk to Gary Mead from Fruitful Furnishing Sawmill and Gary Mead Gallery. Tonight's topic is bark peeling and tanning in the Catskills past and present. We're saying off the air before, Gary, that the tanning industry is kind of a secret.
Yeah, it is. It's very. There's so much that's unidentified with it, and you know the research. You know, when the guy wrote this book about Zodak Pratt, 1802, Zodak Senior was importing hides from other countries and tanning them. But before that, and they've been tanning hides for thousands of years, but there's nobody documented too much about it, and it's kind of like a secret, and I'm not really sure why that is, but there's not a lot written down about it, and yeah. The research that was done on, you know, books, that, and you said the same thing. There are very few books that are written on tanning and the industry, and, you know, that dates back before, you know, 1800.
They're very few. I do some hobby tanning of deer skins, but I think the reason is because when this industry died, which is in the 1860s to the 1880s at the latest, places. I mean, that's a long time ago.
The 1840s when it collapsed, basically.
Yeah.
In certain areas.
Well, Sullivan
County.
That's when
it started.
Yep. Sullivan County, it moved, from what I've read, from east to the southwest.
Right.
So, you know, Greene County into Ulster, and Sullivan was the biggest one. It had the most tanneries in 1860 in New York State.
Right.
The most oxen were in Sullivan County, supposedly, because the oxen were used to haul bark
out
of the mountains. So if you're walking around in the mountains and you come on a very shoddy, narrow trail, which might even be a state trail today, but was actually probably a tan bark road at one time, which is amazing to think about. I mean, it's
and
a long time ago.
Remnants of bark, you know, they piled up in the woods that never got taken out, that are just all moss grown over, and they're mounds.
I've never seen them. In the Adirondacks, I hear, where it was more recent, because Catskills died out earlier, I guess.
Yeah.
Probably since they cut so much hemlock. It moved up into central New York, and I hear that there are some remains, but I've never seen any.
Well, you wouldn't really notice them unless you were actually looking for them.
Yeah.
Like Mike Kudish, you know, he would find them because they would just be a big mound. You know, you might think it's just a mossy rock, but yeah, if you dig into it, it's an old bark pile. But,
well, have you heard our shows with Paul Misko?
Yeah, what?
Paul Misko, he's really knowledgeable about Woodland Valley, and he's documented where a shanty is in the woods that the bark peelers would camp in.
Right.
And he's found their oyster shells where they would, so they knew, he knew they were bringing in oyster shells.
Yeah.
Or whatever, clam shells, or probably clam shells. In any case, we found where it burned, and it was documented, I guess, that it burned down.
Yeah.
And way above it, because fire burns uphill, we found remnants of charcoal where that bark shanty burned down. This is a long time ago, but the cool thing about charcoal is it never really goes away.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, found that fire, that ancient fire from when all those hemlocks were on the ground. Because a lot of these hemlocks, like you said, weren't used, and they were kind of a fire hazard after a while.
Well, the
that's
tops
where the fire towers came in.
Well, the tops of them, you know, all the limbs, because they only, yeah, they didn't peel when the limbs started because it was hard to peel around the limbs. So
yeah,
they only peeled up until where the limbs started. And then, you know, hemlock needles, when they dry out,
yeah,
you just, any kind of a spark will set them up into flames in a heartbeat.
Well, I cut down a 115-year-old hemlock and peeled it. It was already dying, so people were probably like, oh, my God. But it was already dying, so I cut it down and peeled the bark.
Mm-hmm.
I peeled that probably the year my oldest daughter was born, so 2013. That thing looks like I laid it down yesterday without the bark. Once you take the bark off, they last so long. The thing is naked in the woods, like you know, dry and drier than what it would be if the bark was on. So
right,
I could see how it could happen.
Well, the bark actually houses bugs and all that because, you know, that's how wormy pine comes about.
Yeah.
You lay it on the ground, and if the bark comes off, you have that beautiful cambrium layer, no bugs. If the bark is on, all these little bugs, I don't know, they just seem to find their way, and that's when you get the wormy, but they're kind of a big bug. But they, you know, they're under, and the bark holds moisture and creates rot, basically,
yeah.
And once you take the bark off, it actually, the log doesn't dry out, but it doesn't deteriorate. And, you know, a cherry log, you know, I've saw a cherry that's been on the ground for 5 and 6 years, and it's still, you know, moist inside, the bark's off, and you know, basically the part that's on the ground, you know, the bottom log, the sap might be a little bit punky, but
yeah,
you know, the cherry is a good outdoor wood too. That doesn't rot. The heartwood doesn't rot really easy. The sapwood will.
Well, I took these, I sectioned them, and put them in a line because the girls like to jump from one section to the other.
Oh, really?
It's
yeah,
like I laid them down the day. You know, like you said, you're right. Yeah, it hasn't dried out, but it hasn't deteriorated at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the part on the ground will start
yeah,
deteriorating, getting punky.
Yeah.
Because hemlock doesn't like to be on the ground. These old barns, if you go around and notice the hemlock boards, if anything that's touching the ground or where the water's dripping off the eaves or whatever, and they'll rot off at the bottom. But, you know, above that, I mean, these things are 110, 15 years old, these boards, and they're beautiful. They're solid
yeah,
as the day they were put up.
My sap house is made out of hemlock. It's great. It's sturdy
yeah,
as hell.
Hem oak. We always called it hem oak.
Yeah.
It gets harder with age. It really does.
It's crazy. You're just tuning in. You're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is bark peeling and tanning industry in the Catskills, past and present.
Thank you. the love I need. Maybe more than enough. Oh, darling, 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 walk a while with me. Oh, you got so much, so much, so much.
Hey, this is DJ Storm, host of Open House Party. I spin great set lists on WIOX, and I'm also the executive director of the Pine Hill Community Center, a supporter of WIOX, and home of Catskill Cabaret Radio. If you're looking for yoga or Tai Chi classes, activities for kids, DJ dance parties hosted by me, a thrift shop, or just a welcoming place to hang out, the Pine Hill Community Center is it. Class and activity schedules at pinehillcommunitycenter.org.
WIOX is supported by the Catskill Mountain News, delivering news, features, arts, entertainment, and sports weekly since 1863. Available on newsstands by subscription or online at catskillmountainnews.com. Catskill Mountain News, intensely local, uniquely personal.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John's out tonight. But we have Mr. Mead here. Every third Wednesday, we have Gary Mead from Fruitful Furnishing Sawmill and Gary Mead Gallery. Talk about a different Catskills tree. But tonight, we're talking about bark peeling, and tanning in the Catskills, past and present.
So what are we talking about in the present, Ryan? What kind of...
Well, the tanning industry now?
Yeah.
The tanning industry in the now is pretty non-existent in the United States for the most part. I mean, there's some vegetable tanning would be what the bark tanning industry was, anything made from a vegetable like trees.
Right.
Most tan products are chrome tanned and come from overseas. It's a different chemical process that it's faster and uses different chemicals, but you really can't do it in the United States with the environmental laws.
So what happens to all the cow hides when the cows get butchered? Do they get sent overseas to be tanned?
I have no idea. I'll be honest.
I don't either. I wonder about that.
I know, reading about the Catskill tanning industry, that there was a shortage of hides, and they had trouble getting them. So they were imported from overseas, from Argentina to, I believe, even Australia, maybe, New Zealand and stuff. So they came from all over the world, salted, and made their way probably up the Hudson River, and then finally using animal power, horse power.
Right.
Up the, for Zadok Pratt, it would be up the Catterskill Clove.
Yeah.
And, or the Esopus, or into Sullivan County on probably the Delaware. So, you know, like Keshek.
Some of the imported hides I read about were dried in the sun and then wrapped up and, you know, not packaged well enough. And during the journey here, they, the ones that weren't salted, they got maggots and they rotted on the journey here from going along the river. It's very moist and the humidity, and got into it, and they kind of lost a lot that way. So they started coming up with salting them real heavy to preserve them for the trip here, because that's a lot of traveling to have something that doesn't pan out. You know, you open it up, the crate, and everything's full of maggots, and it's very kind of counterproductive, really.
The tanning industry, like I said, in the present is gone. Basically, we see the remnants of it. A lot of our diverse forests of today are really owed accidentally to the tanning industry. As the tanning industry went through, the forest grew up. And a lot of our nicest black cherry that need lots of full sunlight to grow grew from that period. Or oak. Or hickory and chestnut. Well, no longer chestnut. But blackberries. John Burroughs talks about picking blackberries in the old clearings of the bark peelers. So I think actually it added a lot of diversity. Hemlock forest is great. I love it. But for diversity, it's... For edibility and wildlife habitat, it's really kind of monotonous. It makes the best campsites. It's beautiful.
Well, when I was a kid growing up on the farm, we had a blackberry out in the woods. We picked 100 quarts every August and froze them, and we had blackberries all winter. It was like a chore back then, and I didn't realize they were so good for you. Like I go out and I pick now, but back in those days, I remember walking into a blackberry patch and they'd be towering above your head and you'd be reaching up. And, now I'm bending over in these little bushes around in the pastures and whatnot. And, our farm before we bought it, like 10 years prior, had been logged. And all the tops and everything, the partial sun and the, little clearings and blackberries love it. But, I used to pick blackberries about the size of my thumb. They were so huge.
Yeah.
And I don't see I haven't seen blackberries, only the cultivated ones in the store, which I'd be afraid to eat. But anyway, the wild ones are, they're very delicious, very tasty. And, they're not as big as they used to be. But when I get to New Kingston, I'm living up there, I'm going to cultivate a blackberry patch and just make everything in the right environment. And back when we had the farm also, the cows went out there and they pooped all over the place and kept it lots of fertilizer. Now there's, I mean, there's not much fertilizer out there. Birds fly over, and but that's not like when a cow, you know, makes a mess. But anyway, I think that has a lot to do with it. The black caps by my house, I take very good care of, and I get a heck of a yield off of that. But we're getting off the beaten path of tanning and bark peeling. But
there's,
if anybody's
interested,
there are bark spuds that I have an antique that I got from Joe Hewitt when I was peeling my bark for my house, the tulip poplar. I was up to Joe buying some honey from him, and I was telling him about the bark mill. Oh, he says, I got this bark spud in the back. You know, this old timer gave it to me. He said, you can use it, but, you know, I kind of like to have it back. This was hand hammered, and they're called a beaver tail. And, you know, the shovel of a handle, you know, and they're shaped. But this was all handmade, and the finger, where you put your fingers in the handle, they were carved to fit your fingers grips. And it's such a beautiful, and the whole handle was made out of white oak, and you could see the hand hammered steel. And then I bought a new bark spud from a chainsaw dealer, and that was called a beaver tail. The handle of that is hickory. It's very modern looking, but this other one, actually, it looks more like a beaver tail than the beaver tail I bought, the newer one. But I use two bark spuds when I'm peeling bark, and all they are is they have a metal end. Mine are about 24 to 30 inches in length, and they have a curved end to kind of follow the contour of the log. So I take my chainsaw, I score just under the, you know, just through the bark, and then I just start with these two, and I just push it under, and it comes off, and as soon as you get the heavy part of the bark on the back side of the log, it just flops off on the ground. And I made a mistake when I was first started peeling. You know, I was peeling 16-foot logs, and then I went to climb over the log, and I'm telling you, that's slipperier than wet ice. Man. I had no control. I just, you know, I put my foot on it to step over it. I did a split, hit it on my groin, and just fell to the ground. Like in a split second, I go, holy smoke, yeah. I'm not doing that again.
I cut the logs up into 4 to 5 foot lengths.
Well, I don't, because I saw them afterwards, so I leave them full length.
Them, yeah.
And when I get the bark on the ground, because I put pallets on the back side where the bark falls, and then I cut them 52 inches. The bark and palletize them that way. But, you know, 4-footers are so tough to saw. You know, I could saw a 10 and 12 footer, and half the time it takes me to saw 2 4-footers.
Yeah, well, most people don't have a mill, though, Gary.
Yeah.
I'm talking about like someone doing this
right,
in the woods.
Someone doing it like you.
You it in the 4 foot and you just score it on both sides of the line. And that way, when you peel it, half of it comes off and you can easily pick up a half.
Right, yeah.
And stack it.
Yeah, because it is heavy.
It's heavy.
It is heavy. You'd be surprised.
You should put it out in the sun and dry it a little.
Yeah.
But I just want to mention, since we're talking about bark peeling and tanning, we got to mention chestnut oak, because chestnut oak has probably, to be honest, when I read about it, hemlock was second best to chestnut oak.
Yeah.
The Union Army supposedly, after a while, was only accepting chestnut oak, because there's catechols and there's pyrogols, there's different chemicals of tannins, and apparently if you had both, that was great, but apparently one was more accepted a dye,
right,
that the Union Army wanted more, which is black, I guess.
Yeah.
They put some kind of dye in it, and chestnut oak took it up better. But so chestnut oak is really thick bark, but I have not unlocked the mystery about when it peels good.
Okay.
I haven't.
I mentioned that cut it a year, cut it now, and then let it sit till next year at this time, and the bark falls right off.
That'll probably work. The reason why I wanted to come off and process it is because you do leach a little bit of tannins out as the bark
over the
sits.
Years sitting.
Yeah, over the years. So yeah. It's best. I don't know how much that's true with chestnut oak because it's so thick. It probably doesn't leach much. But with hemlock, I've been, you know, when they you so they would peel it in the summer, obviously, and then come back in the wintertime to take it away.
Yeah.
But they would stack it like a roof. So the
right.
first one would leach, but then after that.
It was all protected, yeah.
It was all protected.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I have a poem for tonight. I haven't read this one in a while. And this is one of my favorites, and it's called Dances with Wood. And I wrote this in 2017, 10:30 at night. I think I was just getting ready to go to bed. Born into this world, no choice of mine. I arrived here knowing nothing at all. Memories vague from age 2 to 5 years. Sent to school then, scared and surprised. Best memories ever was being in the woods. That is when it started, keeping me light on my feet. My life was about dances, dances with wood. When the dance started, too young to realize, as I was aging, the pull got stronger and closer. As I realized nature, it became clearer and clearer. In the beginning, thought all thought as I, and what keeps grinding at me, not many thought as do I. Beloved nature and all it provides, being tossed to the side. So I continue dancing, keeping me light on my feet. My life was about dances, dances with wood. Walking in the mountains, fields, valleys, and streams. Noticing birds, reptiles, fish, plants, animals, and trees. But the strongest pull would be the dances, dances with wood. When I am summoned, my nature becomes wood. What always appears, only described as good. Keeping me light on my feet. Dances, dances with wood. Cutting into a log, the aroma fills the air, such as musical notes, each owning its own space. Dancing in my mind, planing, cutting, drilling, shaping, finishing, magic suddenly becomes viable in this world I become to know. Magic suddenly visible, keeping me light on my feet. Till my time here is over, I'm summoned to dances, dances with wood. And that's my poem for this evening. And we're just about running out of time, but we do have a few more minutes to talk about. I think if you haven't been to Prattsville to the museum or to Pratt Rock, you should really take a Sunday or a Saturday and some a little bit of spare time and just spend an hour or two going over there, going through it. And I know I'm going to. I drove by that. My dad was born in Prattsville, actually. And I have never been to the, until I read this book, I have never been so inspired to go there and learn more about it. And, my dad's an old, he's born in Prattsville and raised in Jewett, and I have, still have uncles that live in Hunter and Jewett, and it's a beautiful area over there. There's many. I mean, we have the best wood in the world here, and these mountains are so diverse with what we have, and we need to kind of. I say it every time I'm on the air, we need to become maybe a little bit better stewards. And without understanding what we have, we cannot become a better steward. Most people think, oh, we're going to keep forever wild. We're not going to do anything with our property. We're just going to let it grow. That's the best thing. It isn't the best thing. It's actually probably the worst thing that you can do is to not do something on your property. It's like not cleaning your house or not driving your car. It's going to deteriorate and it'll self-destruct without constant being there and pruning and looking and taking out the disease stuff and keeping the better stuff of, tipping over the saplings that are just going to grow up and die anyway and feeding the animals and making shelters for rabbits and food for deer. And because our forests have become a bit overgrown. And I know my son Mitch, he's out there, and he bought a 10-acre parcel in Pine Bush, and he's got all kinds of trees, and he's, this time of year, he's tipping over the, you know, he has so many soft maples growing there that they're just going to, that's what they do. They grow up, and they can't get the light they need to survive, and they die. So you tip them over, you know, when they're 4 or 5 inches in diameter, some of them, if they look like they're struggling for life, and then you're creating, you know, better light for the trees that are healthy, and you're creating healthier deer and a better habitat for the animals that live there. And then it, you know, kind of deteriorates, and when the wood dries out, we always take it into camp, you know, or Mitch uses it for firewood after, you know, the deer are finished with it. He'll go and cut the rest of it down for the next season to, and then if they, like in a big woods, if you're doing that, just going to open up a little canopy, and maybe some blackberries or some kind of berry bush will grow. But anyway, learn about our forests and trees, and just keep learning about them. I mean, I've been studying them for the better part of 50-60 years, and I'm just scratching the surface myself, and I can't imagine how Mike Kudish feels. I mean, he's just in the mountains constantly gathering more and more information. He's always finding new stuff all the time, and he's such an excitable person that, you know, we know we don't know everything, and we're starving to learn more. And you know, the Catskill Forest Association is a great place to start. If anyone doesn't know how to take care of their property, become a member, and you know, you get free advice out the gate, and they'll always call it. If you have a question and call them, you know, they'll do the best they can to answer it. They'll come and they'll walk your property and give you a you know, maybe you should do this or do that, and take your old apple trees and make them into viable fruit again. And it's a lot of work, but it's worth it in the end. And we just keep foraging forward, and that's what we do.
Thanks for coming on tonight, Gary.
You're welcome.
And if you missed it, you missed another one of From the Forest. Up next is Mostly British with Rick Neblong. Have a good night.
You too. Peace, everybody.
The bottle was his friend, and the old man stumbled in. From the forest, up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way. Getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long-forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games. In an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river runs down from the forest.
Hi, this is Ray Pucci, host of Catskills Commerce, alternate Thursday afternoons at 1 p.m. on WIOX Roxbury, serving New York's Catskill Mountain region at 91.3 FM, WIOX Radio.